welcome to Red Ice Radio. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, and we are glad, as always, that you're with us today. On our websites, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com, you can hear interviews and investigations on a wide variety of important topics. We are dedicated to thought-provoking material that questions the established sacredness of our times, and we look at the issues behind the headlines and what the mainline media outlets or old media, and many in the new media as well, refuse or dare not to look at. Maybe they don't know about it, which is, of course, one of the reasons why we're doing this radio program. We have another very interesting show for you lined up today. Gordon Kennedy is our guest. He is a researcher and author that has dedicated many years of work on the topic of the Guanches of the Canary Islands, the White Indians of Nivoria, and the untold story of the last Stone Age Indo-European tribes. This is some very interesting work we're going to discuss here today. A little bit later, we're going to get into the politics of white Indians as this shocking realization dawns on people. They might feel that PC itch kick in, so we'll address some of that as well. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have a lot to get to here, so let's get to it. Hi, Gordon. Welcome, and thank you for being here with us. It's very good talking with you today. I hope you're doing good. It's nice to have you on the program.
Thanks, Henrik. Appreciate being here.
I've picked up a copy of your book a couple of months ago, The White Indians of Nivoria. Very interesting work. I've been visiting your website quite a bit and looking at some of the research and material you have there as well. It's just a fascinating topic, and of course one we do not hear that much about. Why don't you just tell us kind of first how you got into this work and when you started looking at some of the, magnificent work of Thor Heyerdahl, our Norse explorer. I know that you dedicate the book to him as well. So when did you encounter his work?
It was in 1975, and I'd read the book Kon-Tiki, which is probably his bestseller. It sold, I think, close to 60 million copies and was translated into who knows how many languages, maybe 60 or 70 languages. And he mentioned the Canary Islands in there, in passing. And this was 1947, or maybe a few years after the expedition that he published the book, but a long time before he ever crossed the Atlantic Ocean, which was 1969 and 1970. So even at that point of his career, he was thinking that if he was sailing from the coast of Peru into Polynesia, that to have gotten that far, his theory to make it complete would be somebody would have had to have crossed the Atlantic Ocean too, in some kind of a vessel in prehistoric times. And the Canary Islands are on this route. And he just mentioned Canary Islands on one page, the natives who lived there, and that planted the seeds for me. And I think it was maybe within a year after that I was doing research on islands all over the world, Indian Ocean, Pacific Ocean, Atlantic Ocean. When I reached the Atlantic, I found out that there weren't very many inhabited islands in the Atlantic Ocean. The Western Atlantic, yes. You have the Caribbean islands were inhabited, but in the Eastern Atlantic you have Madeira, the Azores, and the Canaries, and the Cape Verdes. And they were all uninhabited, except for the Canaries, and they had approximately 150,000 people living in them, scattered over seven islands. And as soon as I found out about these people, I just decided that was very fascinating, and I needed to get some information about it, and there wasn't much available. So I had to dig a little bit farther, and then a little bit farther, and pretty soon it became kind of an evocation for me, kind of a passion. And I started to accumulate all the books and information I could get, and I subscribed to an English-speaking newspaper to the Canary Islands, and I made a trip there and spent a month in four of the islands and established a lot of correspondence with a lot of different people. And so this is how I kind of got into this in the beginning.
Very good. I mean, it's a fascinating culture, and again, one that we seldom hear about, unfortunately. We'll get into some of the kind of the politics, if you will, of this a little bit later. There's a lot of kind of controversy around this kind of stuff and a lot of political correctness. I know you've talked about that in some of your, videos as well surrounding this topic. But let's just kind of spend some time of trying to explain of, who we're talking about here, what kind of culture this were, the Guanche or the white Indians also as they're referred to. Tell us about them, what we should, what we should know in terms of origins, where they, came from, how they ended up on the islands, and then we can get into a little bit later of how they lived.
Well, when Columbus made his maiden voyage in 1492, the Spanish were using the word indios, which means Indians, in reference to all the native tribes, including the Eastern Atlantic tribes out there in the Canary Archipelago. He departed from San Sebastian Gomera, which is one of the Canary Islands, on September 6, 1492, and 33 days later, he landed in the Bahamas. And Columbus, because he'd studied some of the chronicles of Marco Polo, he thought he was on his way to Japan. And so he wasn't sure how far he had to go, and it was only him that really had all the faith and the inclination to want to take this expedition seriously. And when he landed there, again, they were using the word Indios on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. So I spoke with a professor, and he teaches Native American studies, and he's part Indian himself. And he said that, as far as his research is concerned, the word Indios was used all over the Atlantic Ocean in reference to the native tribes there. It's not a racial designation. It doesn't have anything to do with pigment or skin color. It just means natives of the Indies, because Columbus was on his way to the Indies. He wasn't trying to get to India. He was trying to get to the East Indies. And Japan is on the way. And it's very possible that until the day he died, he thought that he landed off the coast of Japan. He made three or maybe four subsequent voyages after his first voyage. And the whole time there, if you study his chronicles, he keeps using the word Indios in reference to the natives. Not long after that, when the Spanish had crossed into the New World, North, Central, and South America, and then gone into the Pacific, they were using the word Indios everywhere, too. And so the word Indios, which we call Indians in English, is not a racial designation. It just means natives of the Indies. The Spanish even used it in the Philippines, way on the western side of the Atlantic. So the word Indians is a reference to the natives of the Indies. And as to how the people in India were called Indians, that's another matter. I think it might have something to do with the fact that the Indus River, some of the old maps from those days call the people in India Hindus, or it was called, they were called, it was called Hindustan at that point in history.
Right.
But anyway, this is how we call the Guanches Indians. I've come across this word Indios in a lot of the old chronicles from 300 to 400 years ago. And but we're talking about a population of bearded, light-skinned people, basically, that were connected with North Africa and the Eastern Mediterranean and possibly parts of Southern Europe. And as far as the true origins, we don't know. There were probably several migrations to the Canary Islands. They had to have been boats or ships big enough to carry sheep and goats, and they had dogs with them, and they brought grains and certain types of fruits and things like this. And as far as the time frame, we're talking probably 2,000 to 3,000 years ago was maybe the main settlement. The Guanches had a legend that said that they were descended from 60 settlers near the village of Ikot in the north part of Tenerife. But there seems to be some evidence that there were some people there just slightly longer than that, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 years ago even, but maybe not very much. The main portion of the settlement seems to have come about 2,000 to 3,000 years ago. And so, yeah, hombre blanco, these were basically white Indians. The word Indios, it's a political word too, or Indians in America. When you say it, it's in reference to something else. In Canada, they say First Nations. You know, in Mexico, they might use something else. Columbus himself said that when they got to the Caribbean, there were light-skinned, bearded people in the Caribbean too. And some of them had turbans on, some of them had blue eyes, some of them were much taller than the other short, dark-haired people. And there were also very African-looking people all through the Caribbean. This was just what Columbus had to say. Everybody else that came after that said the same thing. Not only were there what you think of as a typical native-looking people with dark hair and bronze skin and a certain stature, but there were also very African-looking people all through the Caribbean, all through Mexico and South America, and also very white-looking people in the New World, lots of them all over the place. They weren't predominantly white people or black people, but they were definitely a very pervasive element is everywhere you looked. And at that point in history, whatever had been the splendor and the glory of these empires, these sun kingdoms, the Incas and the Aztecs and the Mayans, were pr- probably in decline or had already completely collapsed by that point in history, by 1492.
Right.
And in the Canary Islands, we know that there was mummies. They could never hide the fact that there was mummies there. Most of the chroniclers and the scholars had written a lot about these mummies in the Canary Islands, and people had been going there for hundreds of years, pillaging them and stealing them and sending them off and collecting them. And there must have been thousands and tens of thousands of these mummies. But now I think there's probably less than 50 in the whole world that we know about. There might be some more inside the caverns in the Canary Islands that haven't been discovered yet, and that would be an interesting thing to find. That would tell us an awful lot. And that's really part of the problem. Why so little is known about the Guanches is because the archaeological research wasn't handled correctly by the right people. There's political overtones. The Spanish government would like people to think that nothing important ever happened in the Canary Islands until the Spanish got there. Because there's a lot of people that live in the Canaries that would like to become independent from Spain. And just like all the other New World colonies in Mexico and Cuba, etc., there's pro-independence movements in the Canary Islands, and a lot of them try to align themselves with the native population, and they have their own views of history, too, about what they think happened in the past. So we know there were mummies, and this seems kind of unusual. Here we are, these Atlantis in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, a post-Neolithic culture, people living virtually in the Stone Age, because these are volcanic islands, and there's no metal in the Canary Islands. So they've got all these mummies. These are very elaborately designed mummies that were embalmed by priests and people that knew exactly what they were doing, sewing these things up and storing them in the tombs, in the catacombs of the Canaries. So that was always kind of interesting to me, but I was more interested in the fact that here were these people that were living in something that was probably very close to a paradise, you know?
Right.
In the Middle Ages, and for thousands of years they were there, and this was when Europe went through the Roman expansion and the Crusades and just horrible cold winters, and just, you can imagine all the wars and things that were going on. And the Canary Islands are semi-tropical, you know, they have palm trees. And before the 15th century, before the Spanish got there, where there were streams flowing everywhere and there was water coming out of the mountains, it was snow-capped Mount Tady, and it must have been magnificent. The Spanish had cut down about 95% of the forests. So this was really probably the last true paradise of so-called Western man. And the Greeks and the Romans had written about it and talked about it. They had names for it, like Elysian and Hesperides and Nebaria and things like this. And they just, some of it was accurate, some of it was maybe a little bit embellished. So my intentions were to just try to focus on what we could gather together as far as information, collecting everything I could from every source, corresponding with a lot of people. And that's what my archives are about. And so that's my main interest. You know, besides the pyramids, we've also now found out about, besides the mummies, we found out about these pyramids. And this has caused a lot of controversy within the culture there. Because for years and years, it appeared to be that there were no pyramids. Nobody ever talked about them, but I'd seen references to them in old books that were 200 to 300 years old. And all of a sudden, somewhere in about 1990, this article comes out in this English-speaking newspaper in Tenerife. It's talking about these pyramids in the east shore of Tenerife over near Güímar in Chicona. And when I saw the article, I said, man, that's incredible. Look at this. And I saw this. And so right away, I wrote a story. I wrote a letter to the author. And I don't know if he ever got the letter, but I never received a response. But within just a matter of weeks and months, it was just all over the newspapers, everywhere. Everywhere. I don't know if you heard the story about how this happened and what came of this.
Not in detail, actually. I thought maybe we could talk a little bit more about that later, because there's just, I mean, as you talk here, there's just so many components to this story, which is absolutely, you know, fascinating. But before we kind of move on and talk a little bit more about the culture and how they lived and even how they looked and everything else, what type of, you know, religious practices and everything else they had. You mentioned something that I want to just dwell on for a moment, which was that, you know, what later occurred basically around the entire world is something that actually first occurred in Europe. And this is a point where a lot of people also kind of don't consider it this way. These islands seem to have been a refuge, if you will, then, for how more, you know, pagan-oriented native European cultures lived for many thousands of years before the, you know, Romanization of the world. We, of course, have the dawn of Christianity, and you even talk in your book about, you know, some of the more northern European countries that were last to be Christianized. But there were actually, there seems to have been a lot of parallels between these cultures, or the culture in the Canary Islands, and the cultures of native Europe, basically. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit and just kind of try to get this point across that it's a lot of people hold a view that white people today are somehow, they never had a culture like this, that they never were, even the word indigenous is something that they don't use on European, although, of course, that is a fact. That's where, you know, we come from originally. But how would you explain this to people in terms of what kind of life they had there, and what are the parallels to other previous European culture before Christianization?
Well, that's true. Even if you take the word Indians out of the picture, Guanches were definitely what you'd call natives, or they were indigenous. And this has caused the most controversy. I've looked on the site analytics for my website, and I'm very surprised to see that a lot of the traffic on my website, whiteindians.com, comes from California. A whole bunch of it does. And the rest of it, a good portion, comes from the rest of America. And in America, when you're talking about the word indigenous or native populations, or spiritual descendants of some kind of a primitive culture, it does not include what you'd call light-skinned people for the most part. I mean, we know about Celts and Teutonic people, we know about Europe, but that was a little bit different, you know, and it's so far back. Most of the records we have of the Celts and the Teutonic people come from their enemies, the Romans.
Yes, exactly.
Know, who were benching their skulls, you know. And there is a reference to the Romans having gone to the Canary Islands, and it seems to either be a blank chapter in history or else just a very empty chapter. King Juba's expedition, and they said that they saw dwellings on the shores and everything, but it's very clear that the Romans never really had any impact in the Canary Islands, and so the Guanches or whoever were there at that time were allowed to flourish. But yeah, there was something that was ancient, and it had something to do with this cosmology, with the sun and the pyramids and the mummies and all of this stuff, and it probably went back to Sumeria, or somewhere in the Fertile Crescent, somewhere in that region, maybe 5,000 or 6,000 years prior to that. And there were vestiges of it all across North Africa and into the Canary Islands. There's parallels between the Guanches and some of these tribes they call the Berbers up in the High Atlas Mountains in the Reef District. Some of the parallels are very striking. And all across North Africa, this isn't very well known, but there were also small pyramids, truncated pyramids, all the way to Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia. Egypt is famous for the big pyramids, but there were many, many hundreds of little smaller pyramids and mummies, too. They practiced mummification all across North Africa. The Arabs came across North Africa in the 7th century, and from then until now, everything has become diluted, and things have changed a lot. Just like after the Spanish got to the Canary Islands, everything changed a lot. But whatever they were doing in the Canary Islands, religion was the core of what they believed in, this cosmology that they had going on. And we're not absolutely positive if some of the core elements of what might have been some of the first migrations might have been some kind of a slave colony set up by the Phoenicians, or some kind of a colony where the people were simply planted there for the production of foods, or to raise fish and to raise grains and to raise fruits and everything, so that the Phoenicians or whoever was active in that part of the Atlantic Ocean, maybe even the Sumerians, could have a retreat, a little, you know, place off the shore where they could have little harbors where they could plant their boats and plan their expeditions, do their raids and whatever they had to do. And they might have just simply gotten a colony going there. And there's a lot of parallels between what was going on in the Eastern Mediterranean, all across North Africa and the Canary Islands, the way these people lived and the way they practiced. But it's clear that when the Spanish got there, and the Portuguese and the French in the 15th and the 14th century, they spoke to these people in every language that they knew, and they didn't understand any language at all. There was something very different going on here, and there was kids running around with blonde hair down to their waist, just completely naked all over the place, you know. And they were strong. They were just magnificently strong people. They would climb up to the top of these, you know, rock pinnacles carrying big logs with them and performing exhibitions of wrestling and things like that and swimming. It was just like a whole world unto itself. And it just seems to be some of the parts of it are just almost too unbelievable for people to think that it could be true. And I think part of the deception has to do with this, all these books about Atlantis, because they keep thinking you're talking about Atlantis or something, you know, or
right.
that this must be Atlantis. And I think that the literal definition of Atlantis is something like Island of Atlas or whatever, and that over on the Moroccan coastline, you've got, up in the mountains there, you've got the Atlas Mountains, you know, and you've got, there's different tribes over there in Morocco and stuff like this, and you can see the Canary Islands from the African shore there. And my understanding is that if Plato's interpretation is taken literally, then he said something like the 10th millennium B.C. So that's 12,000 years ago. And this is not the time frame we're talking about. I mean, the Guanches were there only a few thousand years ago. You know, and you can't say that there was just some big landmass out there and that it sunk and that these were the island tops and that these people didn't understand anything else and they brought the mummies and the pyramids. That doesn't make any sense at all. You know, it's almost like saying nobody knew how to sail.
Right.
See, as soon as you know what's in the picture, everything changes. You know, you can cross the Atlantic Ocean, you can cross the Pacific, you can go around Africa or anything. And I think the people did know how to sail. Most of the books about the Guanche say they didn't know any form of navigation, but I don't believe that's true. I think they did know how to sail. And at that point, it might have only been within the islands. They might have been just doing navigation from one island to the other. But certainly they got there by boats to begin with. And so whoever dropped them off or however they got there to begin with were from people that were planned expeditions. And they knew how to get there. They didn't come from some sunken continent. And part of the Guanche languages has these very strange words that are just people names and place names that start with A-T. You know, I mean, if you were writing a book about Atlantis or something and just trying to come up with some imaginary fictitious names, you couldn't do any better. These were actual Guanche names, you know, that started with A-T. You know, and they were just dozens of them all over the place, and they were place names, too. And so I think some of the true historical data from the Canary Islands and the Guanche culture has been commingled with all these fictitious books that these people are trying to make money on about Atlantis. And so
right.
Intentions were to just discard Atlantis completely and just go with the Canaries, what we know of the hard science about the Canary Islands. But yeah, the religious part of it is definitely true, because Christianity is not the religion of the Northern European people at all.
Exactly.
On them are the Romans. And the Romans weren't necessarily real religious or spiritual themselves, but under Constantine, they decided to make that the state religion. And so that they could just, you know, if you've ever read The Conquest of Gaul by Julius Caesar, or Tacitus' book about Germany and the Agricola about Britain, you can see what the Romans did to Europe. They
yes.
just destroyed it everywhere they could. And if you look at the way the Guanches lived, there were definitely many parallels between them and the Germanic people. One of the most notable is just the way the women are treated. The women were treated exceptionally well in the Canary Island culture. The Guanche women were strong. They were independent. They could get a divorce anytime they want. They could own property. Even in the Viking age, a Viking woman could own property or have a divorce.
That's right.
And that was anywhere in the Mediterranean. Nowhere in you know, even 1,000 years ago, you know, women were not treated good in the Mediterranean. Spain, North Africa, you know, and all those countries, probably better in Berber culture. Until after the Arabs arrived, but definitely not in Spain and Portugal and Rome and Turkey and in Greece and those countries. Women were not treated well, and they really still aren't compared to the way women are treated in Sweden and Norway. You know, women have a lot more political and social and spiritual prominence in those cultures. But yeah, you could say that the white man was really robbed of their divinity at some point in prehistory, and the connection that the white man had with the earth, little by little, it was taken away on account of basically the stumps of European paganism had Christianity grafted onto it. And also, you can't really blame the historical figure of what we call Jesus or Christ. You know, he was a guy who hung out with, you know, prostitutes and fishermen somewhere over there in the Eastern Mediterranean. He can't be blamed for what the Romans did. You know, the historic Christ. You can't really say that it's, you know, somebody like that would be the reason why Europeans lost their divinity. I mean, nobody in Northern Europe amongst those Teutonic people, and nobody in the Canary Islands was waiting for the world to end or for some kind of a resurrection or
right.
thinking about it'd be nice if we could get to the Garden of Eden or whatever. I mean, as far as I can see, the Guanches already lived in paradise.
Right.
For that matter, part of the reason that Swedes and Germanic people love the sun so much is because before they lived in place up there so far north, they used to live in a place that was much warmer. And I would bet it was probably near the Black Sea or the Caspian Sea or somewhere in that region. It's that the people we call Swedes, Norwegians, Germans, Dutch, all those Northern European people migrated after the ice melted.
Yeah, did you ever hear about Thor Heyerdahl's, you know, kind of theory about, you know, we have the Aesir who were, you know, later, who came up to the northern areas, which, of course, is the foundation of the native belief system there called Asatru. Aesir is related to Aesir. And so he actually had an idea, a theory that they actually came from the area of Azerbaijan, which is today called, you know, Bajan, but then that they came from at least Asia or Azer, right? And they actually migrated up there, and that this might be the correlation. I don't know if you heard about that before, but Thor Heyerdahl, I know he pointed out the striking similarities between a lot of the artwork between this area, specifically a place called Gobustan, which is very desolate today. It's like a desert out there, but it's very striking rock carvings you can find all over Scandinavia. So I just thought that was interesting, you know?
Yes, I'm familiar with that. Right near the end of his life, he published a book, something about Scandinavian ancestry tracing roots to Azerbaijan. And he said that originally a lot of the people there were fair and Nordic looking in that part of the world. And I would say that that's true all over the Black Sea and the Caspian and those areas. Iran means Aryan, you know, all of these places, Indo-European culture. What happened was basically the people that stayed there in those places mixed with the descendants of their slaves and these other people that came at different points in history. That's
yeah.
a popular place to live. Whereas the ones who migrated north, it became Germans and Dutch and Danes and Swedes and Norwegians or whatever. They didn't mix with too many people, except maybe the Lapps or some of the Asiatic people that were there. And so they stayed homogeneous in their population. They look Nordic, and a lot of them still do, because they didn't mix with people. But down in the Mediterranean, in the Eastern Mediterranean, in the Black Sea, in those areas, they did mix. And so they took on a darker hue over centuries. And, that book was published near the end of his life, and I don't know if there was even an English translation. But he was saying that as far back as 1969 and 1970 in the raw expeditions. He said, if anything, the migrations were from south to north. Because in Carlton Kuhn's book, Tribes of the Reef, which was published by Harvard University in 1931, he used the expression Nordic African. And it sounds like a contradiction in terms, but the Berber people, the original fair Berber people, and there's still plenty of them left, in the high Atlas Mountains, were Nordic. They were tall and they were Nordic, just like the Guanches. And if we wonder what the Guanches look like, look at some of these pictures, go to Google Images and punch in Berbers and blondes, and they'll come up all over the place. There's a lot of Berber people, and these are Nordic people that are native African people. And that's almost certainly what the people, you know, around the Black Sea and the Caspian and these regions look like, too, 3,000-4,000 years ago. And word got out when they sent scouts up north, and they said, hey, there's another Black Sea up there, and they call it the Baltic. And so they followed the rivers, and they took off, and they went up there. And the reason they went because it was not because they enjoyed the cold climate or that they wanted to get farther north where they could freeze for 6 months of the year. They went for political reasons, because they didn't want to get their skulls bashed. It's the same as now. In the cities in America, when things get horrible and deplorable, and you look at your children growing up, you say, you want this to happen to our kids, and you turn on the news, and it's so bad. And so people take off, and
yeah.
they go way up there to Montana or Idaho or Wyoming or someplace.
That's right.
To get away. And exact same thing happened 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. People said, let's get out of here. Let's get out of this region that's too popular. All of these empires have brought in all of these people through the slave labor. Now the slaves are uprising. Everybody's bashing each other's skulls. There's wars and everything. And they said, life can be more peaceful up there. And it's cold, and it's a little bit harder to live up there, but there's plenty of fish. There's plenty of places to live. And so that's what the people did. They followed the rivers like the Volga and all these other major tributaries up into Russia, up into Northern Europe, and there they stayed. And some of the other ones went west across North Africa and into the Canary Islands, and that's where they stayed. And so looking at basically, the Guanches are basically first cousins to the Germanic and the Celtic people. Some of them went west, some of them went north, and that's what happened.
That's very interesting. I mean, especially considering actually what's happening today as well, and maybe we can talk a little bit more about that later. It seems to be a repeat in history as these empires, kind of create conditions where there is wherever there has been, you know, peace and tranquility, there is they bring a very kind of a disruptive, you know, culture, shall we say. But we'll see if we can get into that a little bit more later. But one of the things I want to talk a little bit about as well is the possibility then that they are, the Guanches are maybe more closely related to Cro-Magnon man. And I mean, there's a tendency here to believe that they were maybe, you know, not intelligent. You know, some of these sources, so-called, that were, you know, from civilized areas, you know, mentioned that they were, you know, you get concepts of the barbarians and the, you know, kind of uncivilized people and whatnot. But I mean, it's clear when you read your book that you realize that these people were intelligent. They were strong. They were beautiful. They had a tremendous architecture, especially considering when we look at the pyramid cultures and everything else. And so this is not something that was, you know, quote, uncivilized, unquote. This is actually, you know, highly, you know, skilled people and whatnot. So that's a big part of this as well. And you pulled out a lot of the passages and sources from other older books, I think all the way back from like 1503 up to, you know, 1970 or something like that. Different smaller passages, but still from different books where they have been mentioned, and they seemed like they were people to be admired, correct?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I've published other things on the Guanches, too, in the past. In this current edition, The White Indians of Navarre, it has the color pictures, and I condensed it down to the most important details. But before, I'd published things that went into great detail about the houses on Gran Canaria that they built, and they had walls that were 9 feet thick, and the stones were fitted perfectly, and they had timbers from laurel trees and canary pines that were covering the roofs and everything. When they ran out of caves, they had to build rock houses. And they were just whole villages, just magnificent villages that were completely destroyed by the Spanish, you know, and there's nothing of them left. And so they knew how to build. They lived well, and things were fantastic. They had very few severe wars and the kind of things that were going on in other parts of the world. I mean, they had their own intertribal conflicts, and there were some battles, but they always had festivals every year in August. The Venice Men, what it was called, and it was a big giant gathering where all the tribes would get together and put aside their differences. It must have been really something, especially on Tenerife. But all of the islands have their own charm, and they still kind of do. Canaries is still a very interesting place to this day. The Spanish cut down about 95% of the forests, and I think the desertification of like the Sahara influence is having an effect that streams are drying up there. But it's still, I was really quite taken. I thought it kind of reminded me of a cross between California and Hawaii, because it is very much of a desert climate, but yet you've got a lot of tropical plants, and the ocean was warm in November when I was there, and the mountains were full of snow and pine forests. And you can just imagine looking at all these caves and just the way that people could be there on the beach and live in the terraces where they could grow their foods and things like this. It was just amazing. There's really nothing like that in Europe or even North Africa. I mean, this was for European-like people to be living in a place like this. It's almost like the Tarzan kind of a dream. When Edgar Rice Burroughs published Tarzan in 1912, it was fiction, and he personally didn't think it was going to take off. But just that concept of living like that, you know, was so well entrenched in people's minds that the book became a massive bestseller. And it's been translated into hundreds of languages. There was a TV show. There were movies about it, hundreds of Tarzan films. They named a city after him. And the Guanches were essentially that. They were living on African islands. There was 150,000 Tarzans and Janes living on these islands. And the Greeks knew about it, and the Romans knew about it. And this was the indigenous white man's world. And yeah, they had their own cosmology and their own religion, which wasn't Christianity, and it wasn't really Celtic or Teutonic, but it was something similar. It was a nature kind of a thing. And I get letters from kids, you know, that are college students that have studied anthropology, and they've happened upon my website or whatever. And they're a little bit cautious about approaching me because they know that they're going to get in trouble if they bring this up in class. You're not allowed to talk.
Right, yeah.
This couldn't be real. I've had other people, especially on YouTube, all the comments that come on YouTube, it's the biggest race war I've ever seen in my life. But they said the Guanches were all African, black Africans and Asiatic people. There were no people with light skin there and all this kind of stuff. I mean,
right.
It's unbelievable. Despite the chronicles and despite all the mummies that we have and the radiocarbon testing and the dating, and Cro-Magnon, even in the dictionary sometimes, just a common dictionary, it'll say Cro-Magnon man, you know, came upon the earth from somewhere 30 to 40,000 years ago, and they'll even say that there were living Cro-Magnon people in places like the Canary Islands, you know, and so it's well known. Subspecies Caucasoid, you know, Cro-Magnon. But now, of course, I've also found that the newest dictionaries, when they list Cro-Magnon now Cro-Magnon is no longer a Caucasian. Cro-Magnon is everybody. Now Cro-Magnon, if you can believe that, Cro-Magnon is like, there's no such thing as race anymore, and so Cro-Magnon
exactly.
is Australian. These Hopis, Africans, we're all Cro-Magnons.
Yeah.
You know, and Neanderthal was before. Neanderthal was stupid, but we're smart. So that's the new dictionary definition, the new encyclopedias. And I really feel sad for these kids that are going to school and they have to learn this somewhere on the internet. They can't get it in academia. They
yes.
have to learn it from some website that they call controversial whatever. And I say, just go there to the museums. Go to the Canary Islands yourself. Walk through the museums and talk to some of the people. And you'll see the museums are amazing. They're just like the museums in California. These people were living in the Stone Age, you know. And it's pretty known that they were Caucasians, you know. And if you had just taken a bunch of people from Europe and thrown them down there, they wouldn't have left, you know. They would have wanted to stay there. Of course it was paradise, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting what you're saying here and talking about as well. I mean, we do have the plague of anthropology has become weaponized. I've mentioned that many times before. It's become a tool for political purposes today, unfortunately, with, you know, you have cultural Marxists like Franz Boas who does seek to undermine the values of the West by using skewed biology and anthropology. And, I mean, some people have even referred to it as the paleo police and how this kind of ties into political correctness. I thought that academia and science and everything else should be about, you know, open investigations that lead wherever the results may lead, but that's not the case today, and that's why stories like yours is not only so important, but that's also why, to a large extent, they end up in the back pages, if even that, of reference notes in some of these books, you know.
Well, I've tried to do the best I can, and I'm sure if I belonged to some kind of a university system, they would have fired me a long time ago. You know, if I was within academia, if I was a professor, if I was some teacher somewhere, and I didn't have enough tenure or whatever. Or that if I just, even just if I published the books that I have published on this subject, they would probably be considered controversial in some way. But at the same time, I've met many people here in America that come from Cuban ancestry, Mexican ancestry, African ancestry that believe this. I've explained it to them and explained how it happened and said that really what's happened in the last 520 years after Columbus here in America is almost identical to what must have happened 2,000 or 3,000 years ago.
Yes.
Somebody was using the Canary Islands as a staging point. Columbus took off from Spain, from the Mediterranean. He was Italian, but he got his backing from the Spanish monarchy, landed in the Canary Islands, and 33 days later landed in America. And that's why Hector Herodal did the raw expeditions. He wanted to prove that you could sail even a papyrus boat across the Atlantic Ocean, and it took him 57 days to do it. But all he was trying to do was prove that he was recreating what might have been an original voyage 2,000 or 3,000 years ago by the Phoenicians or the Sumerians, and that they brought science and civilization to the New World. And the hard evidence of that was still in the Canary Islands with the mummies, the pyramids, these dogs that are running all over the place that look more like an Anubis that were in the New World too, the trepanning of the skulls, things like this, you know, they're just hard evidence. It just seems unlikely that a bunch of people living in caves would have things like that going on, and that you know, and so that's just, there's a lot of people that are actually very big fans of this whole kind of thing. It makes perfect sense. It fits better than any of the other theories.
Sure. Yeah. Definitely. Exactly. There's a lot to it. It's very, very interesting indeed, and I think that we deserve to know you know, our own European past, whatever it might be. And I think that a lot of people are kind of, they're hungry for this type of, you know, material as well. There's a desire and the lore. You kind of talk about this in the book as well, of you know, finding some kind of root and an anchoring point of pre-Christian tradition, and finding, you know, there's an attraction to the idea of the noble savage or what have you, that, you know, Tarzan, as you mentioned before, that there's kind of a need and a place for that, to kind of to affirm the idea that we're not out of place. We're actually very much in there. It's not about a trait that comes with our, you know, race or ethnicity. It's rather a religious conquest. I look at it this way, in a way, within Europe, that conquered the Europeans, and then they used the Europeans to kind of try to grab the rest of the world. We've seen this in waves, of course, from Christianity, and now we're kind of seeing this a little bit with Islam as well. Some of these Abrahamic religions have this tendency for conquest, but feel free to comment on that if you want to. But I wanted to talk as well a bit about the Spaniards and why they, because they were in a lot of fights with the Guanches as well. They literally tried to pretty much exterminate them, right? So what happened here, and what was some of the reasonings for why they wanted to, you know, take them out?
Yeah, the Spanish ultimately were the ones that gained upper ground. It took them about 100 years to wipe out the Guanches, all through the 1400s. The Portuguese were there, the French, you know, Prince Henry the Navigator, all of these people. But the Spanish, they were trying to get their hands on anything they could, and it wasn't long after that. They controlled something like 90% of the world power. I mean, they from there they went on to the New World, and the Canary Islands were just a dress rehearsal. The extermination of the Guanches were a dress rehearsal for the conquest of what later became about 100 million American Indians. And just within, almost within Columbus' lifetime, or within a generation after Columbus' lifetime, the Spanish had covered everything from the Canary Islands all through the Caribbean, as far north as Kansas, all the way down to Argentina. Built hundreds of churches, you know, baptized the natives, wiped out 100 million American Indians. When the Indians wouldn't do the work, they brought in African slaves. They brought in African slaves into the Canary Islands, too, and Madeira and all those places. And it was a horrible, bloody fight. I mean, it was much, much harder for the Spanish to wipe out the Guanches than it was to do anything in Mexico or Central or South America. In fact, they had it pretty easy over there. But the Guanches put up a tremendous fight, and it probably gives you an idea of how it was that they were able to last so long to begin with, that they might have the same thing happen before with the Romans or some of the people after them, but they just were blank chapters in people's history, that these people fought so well, and the islands were so well fortified, that whenever they saw a ship, they could whistle the messages all over the islands, and everybody in the island knew that there was a ship approaching. And if people wanted to trade with them and they were fair and square, then everything was fine. But if they didn't want to be fair and square, then the Guanches were more than happy to let them know that this is their place, and this is what they're doing to take care of the place, and that, you know, they're not welcome here if they want to fight. And so the Spanish, of course, this was at the very beginning of firearms, and whatever forms of firearms they had probably weren't very advanced, but they had a lot of bows and arrows, they had horses, they had shields. The Guanches would grab their weapons, too, after they'd have victories and use the Spanish weapons against the Spanish and things like that. But this is one of the bloodiest chapters in European history. It went on for a long, long, long time. So you can see the Guanches were really pretty serious about defending their homeland. I think Tenerife was the last island to fall. It was possibly in about July of 1496. So even 4 years after Columbus had sailed, they still hadn't rounded up all the Guanches, you know.
Huh.
And it was Columbus took off. He didn't land on Tenerife. He took off from Gomera, which is another island. And there were bloody, long, long, bloody battles. Guanches were ferocious fighters. They really knew what they were doing. And I think finally, in the end, it had to do with more like pestilence and disease that did the Guanches in. I think rabies. It was a rabies epidemic that was spread by these dogs, and there were dead bodies all over the place. It's interesting, there's a village on the north shore of Tenerife called Matanza, and that means massacre in Spanish.
Hmm.
And in Mexico, there's a village called Matanza, and in Cuba, there's a village called Matanza. And anywhere in the New World, you find a village called Matanza. It usually is a place where the Spanish had wiped out all the Indians. But in the Canary Islands, Matanza was where 900 Guanches, or 300 Guanches basically wiped out 900 Spaniards, you know. And the Spanish were fully covered in arms and steel and everything, and they had horses and weapons, and the Guanches were just 300 naked people just diving off the cliffs and everything. And to this day, they call that village Matanza, and the modern-day Isleños are pretty sympathetic to the Guanches, and they'll paint these huge murals on the walls, you know, and they put the word Matanza below, like massacre, and they'll have a picture of a Guanche with long hair blowing a conch shell, you know, and looking up into the sky, and then underneath his feet is some Spaniard dressed in full armor laying on the ground dead, you know. And this is kind of a political message to Spain saying, hey, get out, man. Get out. Give us these islands back, you know. And so it's interesting, you know, that they may be the single example in the whole world, in the whole Spanish Empire, where the Indians actually did in the Spanish completely like that, you know, when they were vastly outnumbered. But there's still bones there to this day from that massacre. You know, 500 and 600 years later, they're still digging up bones from when 900 Spaniards were massacred in Matanza.
Wow. Now, I guess it would be a lot of archaeological work that's, well, I hope there is, you know, at least this in some cases too, actually, it gets covered up to a large extent if it doesn't point in the right direction. But a question that kind of latches on from that, are there any lighter descendants today on the island as far as you're concerned? I mean, some of these accounts a few, you know, 100 years ago seems to kind of relate some of this, but it seems to have disappeared largely. Is that correct?
Yeah, the Canaries are so easy to get to, and right now, it's just like everywhere else in the world, it's a measure of status to claim pre-conquest ancestry. So now everybody calls themselves a Guanche in the Canaries. Now it's like, I had some kids recently that were basically couch surfers, or they were world travelers working on farms and things that are traveling around, and they were from the island of Gran Canaria, and they consider themselves artists and musicians, and all through their artwork, they're just putting all of this Guanche symbolism and Guanche cave paintings everywhere. You know, it's really a measure of status, you know. And so when you look at the people, who knows where they're from? I mean, there was even in the 17th century a huge migration of Irish people to the Canary Islands. A lot of the Spanish themselves were already pretty fair-skinned. In fact, I think Cortez was a blonde, you know. But so in Spain, you're going to have the whole spectrum because they're Celtic Iberians, you know, from everything from those who are mixed with Moors and very dark skin with black hair to redheads and blondes. But you've got
from the Gothic, the Visigoth Empire down in Spain, right? It was speculated that these actually come from Goth land up in Sweden, in Scandinavia.
Yeah. I mean, so you've got all the whole spectrum there in the Canary Islands to this day, and a lot of Germans go there to live for the last 50 years, and they mix into the population too, and it's pretty hard. What I would like to see is for somebody to discover a vault of mummies, you know, just somewhere in the mountains, you know, find an opening, go in there and find a huge vault full of mummies, and get somebody to investigate. It's like Thor Heyerdahl when he did in that book Aku Aku when he went to Easter Island, and he knew what he was doing. And I bet they'll find evidence of boats and proper dating methods and biological origins of these people. I mean, all the funerary objects and things like this. The Spanish, if something like that did happen, the Spanish that are running the museums right now, their paycheck come from the Spanish government in Madrid. And they understand that this whole thing about the prehistory of the Canary Islands is directly connected with politics.
Yeah.
And they don't want the Canaries to become independent. They want to keep it as a tourist destination where the Spanish can keep their hands in the cookie jar and make all the money they can possibly make. And so, I've met the fellows that work in the museums. I know American scientists that have gone over there. There was the world's first mummy conference in Tenerife in 1992. I talked to the two most prominent American scientists that went over there and did all the research and set up this mummy conference and brought in scientists from all over the world. And it's pretty obvious, you know, that the people that run the museums there are getting their paychecks from Spain and from mainland Spain, and they completely ignore everything Heyerdahl did with these pyramids down there. They say that the pyramids were just piles of rocks that were set up by the Spanish in the 19th century when they were clearing their fields for growing bananas. So they piled up, you know.
Really?
And they said, they did it on La Palma, too, and Gran Canaria. Oh, yeah, they did it all. So, that's pretty ridiculous. You know, when you look at these pyramids, I mean, they're not magnificent pyramids like you see in Yucatan or Egypt or whatever, but they're truncated mounds. You know, they're like what you'd find in like some of them, they're similar to some in Mesopotamia, and there used to be pyramids like that in Tonga, in Polynesia as well, but they were leveled by the missionaries. And so a lot of the ones in the Canary Islands were leveled, but the people that run the museums there think it's just a pile of rocks, you know? And they're also upset by the fact that a foreigner came in there. Tor Heyerdahl from Norway came in there and brought it to the world's attention. And
right.
He set up a park there. And he got his friend Fred Olsen to buy the land, and they set up a whole park, even after he's dead. People still there, go there all the time. And this is very consistent with his whole theory of prehistoric migration across the Atlantic Ocean, you know, by the Sumerians and such, and the Phoenicians. And so they didn't like here at all. Some people do over there, but the academia doesn't. And but I think they have an idea that there was something much more important going on in the Canaries than history has ever given them credit. In fact, if I mention the Canary Islands to like 100 people here in California, most of them think the Canary Islands are in the Caribbean somewhere.
Huh.
Most of them do. And a few people think it's in South Pacific. You know, and the rest of them get it right. They know it's off the coast of Morocco. But most Americans have no idea where the Canary Islands are.
Interesting. Now, we have a lot more to discuss here. I want to talk more about how these different cultures connect because, of course, as Heyerdahl proved with Ra and Kon-Tiki and some of these other expeditions, that tremendous parallels, really, and it's possible to travel from, Africa through the Canary Islands and then going to the Bahamas or other places in the Americas. So the question here is, of course, if they actually did that as well. Is this a pre-American or pre-Columbian, expeditions that were taking place here, basically? We know about the Vikings, of course, as well, who discovered this, around the year 1000 with the Vinland up in Newfoundland in Canada there. But a lot more of this that I wanted to talk about and discuss, you know, the pyramids, the mummies and everything else. But we're going to do that in a little bit. We're going to take a break shortly here, Gordon. But why don't we talk just a little bit about your website and where people can go to pick up copies of your book. It's called The White Indians of Navarria. And it's very interesting. I've been enjoying it very much. There's a lot of good color photographs in it as well. It's, excerpts from a lot of other sources. And it's, excellently composed to kind of give you a really good overview of what we're talking about here. So give us the details, Gordon, of where people can go to find out more.
WhiteIndians.com is my website. And I have a link to Amazon on there. And if you go on Amazon.com, you can find The White Indians of Navarria there. Published by myself, Gordon Kennedy. And the website is pretty good. It's got a link to two YouTube videos, The White Indians of Navarria Part 1 and then Part 2. And they're like 9 and 11-minute videos, and they go into a lot of detail on there. It's very easy to see. You see all these pictures that I put in the videos and the description. It pretty much explains everything. And unfortunately, a lot of people miss the point. And I was trying to describe what was really a paradise of the European people. It was somewhere down here off the southwestern part of Europe, out there in the Atlantic Ocean. But it turned into this huge political race war, and all these people are all upset and everything like this. And so I just, you can read the comments on there and see what they're all fighting about.
Right.
It's really too bad because they're not focusing on the Canary Islands. They're focusing on America and South America and all that kind of stuff. That was just the after effect. I mean, the Guanches personally would not have wanted to have anything to do with all these wars and turmoil. And you got to keep in mind that these empires, like the Aztecs and the Incas and the Mayans, and even Egypt and Sumeria, almost every one of them was collapsed when Columbus was passing through the Canary Islands. The Guanches were living in paradise out there, in caves and enjoying the beaches and preparing the herbs and drinking tea and growing gardens and things like this. And the Aztecs were sacrificing people, and the Mayan civilization is horrendous beyond words. You know, they destroyed the whole environment in Yucatan. You know, the Mayans, what was left of it was human sacrifice, fouled the water. What actually happened in Yucatan is that when the Spanish showed up, what was left of the Mayans had already destroyed the environment and caused deforestation. The Spanish wiped out the Indians, and then the environment recovered. Imagine is that a plot in a Hollywood movie where the Europeans show up and kill off the Indians, and the environment recovers from all the damage the Indians had done, And when I say Indians or Indios, this is just what the Mayans had created. This was an empire. These weren't like you know, simple pastoral Indians. They weren't like Lakotas or Hopis or anything. These empires like Aztec, Inca, and Maya, and the same thing with Egypt and Samaria. I am not big fans of this kind of thing. This
right.
is just part of the story of what happened, you know. I'm not some person that's saying, oh, look at this. When they see this thing, white Indians in the barrio, what they're thinking is it like somebody from either Atlantis or from Scandinavia came down here in their big golden ships and they marched into America and they set up these civilizations. That's not what it's about, you know. It's not what it's about at all, you know. I don't think anybody from Northern Europe had anything to do with the Canary Islands, except they were descendants of the same people that ended up in the Canaries, but they came from a different route a couple thousand years before, and they went north.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
The migrations were south to north and from east to west. And these empires like the Sumerians and the Phoenicians and the Egyptians and all these people, they were into major damage, you know. I mean, they built magnificent empires, but they had a lot of slaves. And when they couldn't get the work done fast enough, they brought in more slaves, and that's what the Canary Islands may have been. It may have been a slave colony. We're not really sure. But it has all the markings of something like that, where they put these people there for the purpose of producing food. And then when everything else collapsed, they were just stuck there in paradise, and they enjoyed it.
And they outlived their slave masters. Yeah, it's pretty ironic in that regard. I definitely want to talk more about that when we pick up here in the second and how they kind of, you know, this type of mentality brought about their own destruction, because I think we actually are seeing echoes of this in the Western world today. But we'll get into more of that in the second. In the meantime here, whiteindians.com is the website. Check out the book, The White Indians of Navarra. And stay with us, Gordon. We'll pick right up after this break. Well, folks, we have much more to talk about with Gordon Kennedy when we continue with the second hour at redicemembers.com. There are more aspects to his work that we need to put into perspective and discuss other finds, and also how this changes the picture, not only in terms of anthropology, but also European history. We discuss culture, the front of Christopher Columbus, and also other anomalies like the Clovis culture or Salutrians, as being evident first settlers in America. Gordon told us about the kind of conditions that existed in old empires that fell with a very prominent role on massive amounts of guest workers or immigrants. We discuss if we're seeing an echo of this today and what effect this will have in the long term. Gordon discusses the Berber people as an example of what occurred in the past. And later we discuss the slave trade and the Guanches actually being one of the first victims of this. Please join us, folks, at redicemembers.com to hear the rest, the second hour, and all our previous shows, close to 900 programs in our archives, is waiting for you. Sign up and tune in. By the way, more is coming with Nora Gedgaudas, David Everard, Joy Camp, John DeNugent, Mike King, Kai Merles, Frank Salter, and many more. I hope you join us for those shows, but stay with us right now for much more. We'll be right back.